Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
The key to winning big is using every little bit of knowledge to your advantage. At Odds Checker, we give you the edge. Better odds, better picks, and better offers to make you a better bettor. Why settle for less? Quickly compare the odds at every sportsbook to ensure that you're getting the best price to maximize your return. Visit us at www.oddschecker.com/US. Odds Checker. Sports betting smarter.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 10th, 2020. You're listening to the still existing podcast of Chris Cosenza and Scott Long. I'll let you guess who I am. I think this quarantine is making me delusional. I'm sorry.
It's making us all delusional. So
I feel like we are the U.S. Postal Service, except instead of neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from their swift completion of their appointed rounds. It's like neither virus nor empty card rooms nor gloom of bankruptcy stays these hosts from their swift completion of another poker cast. I mean, we're still doing the show. There's still stuff to talk about. It's unbelievable.
I'll tell you though, we are a cat hanging a chalkboard by our claws right now though. So.
The streak may end.
Whoever everywhere I can find for content here, folks.
Whoever thought it was a virus that might end the streak?
Yep.
I mean, seriously, it might have been like boredom, argument, close the company down. You know, no. Some, you know, animal disease is going to take us out.
Animal disease.
Well, we have stuff to talk about, so that's good.
Yeah, we don't eat those bats. We've been all right.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, so a new book called Billion Dollar Hollywood Heist, written by card cheat and TV producer Howard Curtis, is offering more details on the high-stakes Hollywood poker game detailed in the movie Molly's Game. Curtis said he and Tobey Maguire put the game together and stocked it with inferior players so they both could win big, and that Molly Bloom's role in the game has been overblown. Curtis says he won $15 million from the game over the 4 years, though none of the celebrities Curtis mentioned in the book who were contacted by the New York Post would comment.
I tell you, I read the whole story because it was captivating, to be honest with you.
You had nothing else to do, right?
And nothing else to do. So usually I just scan the headline, look at your little summary, and I'm done with it. But I had plenty of time to read this crap. So, one, tragic ending to this guy. I mean, he's not really – I mean, he's living now in Arizona or whatever. But, I mean, he went through a bunch of crap.
Yeah, lost everything, a bunch of health issues and –
I love a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, like, you know, Tobey Maguire was like a germphobe, and and he was real petty, and that we got the most important question answered, that, you know, J-Lo's ass was not cellulite, it was nice. That was one of my favorite lines. Rick Solomon asks Ben Affleck in the middle of the game, hey, so, you know, did her ass have cellulite on it, or, you know, was it nice? Ben Affleck's like, it was nice. I mean, this is the stuff that you didn't get from the movie. Also, that right. Molly was like basically a glorified host and not really anything they made her up to be in Hollywood, right?
Yeah. So, one, the article is salacious.
Yeah.
I'm sure the book is 20 times more salacious because you can only get so much in an article.
Yeah. You've got to make money.
I think the reality is we don't really know what happened in this game. We've got now two versions of it, right? So I don't think this one's any more credible than the other one.
Yeah.
Or more credible, I should say. I mean, I'm any not saying
right.
Incredible. But so, you know, it is, you know, so the journalist in me is very skeptical of this. I mean, obviously he's proud of the fact that he used to be a card cheat, though he says he didn't cheat in this game.
Yeah.
And trust him.
Careful not to win too much.
So the journalism in me is very skeptical that of you know, what he's saying here and how accurate it is. That being said, I was also skeptical of the Molly version. And so at the end of the day, I don't really know what to believe here. But again, this game's over. It's almost like a poker lore thing now that we just talk about and imagine. And there's a lot of time to be imagining right now. So I'm happy to have another take on it to, you know, make me feel part of this probably the most famous poker game probably ever.
Yeah, probably ever.
Going back to, you know, Mark Twain on the Riverboat. Stuff, right? So to that end, I'm going to give him plenty of rope and soak up all the details he gave. And if anybody else comes out with a tell-all book, then I'll be interested in hearing their version of it as well, too. But all that being said, a lot of the stuff, both his version and Molly's version, are believable. So, I mean, I can see it and can see this coming down that way. So while I'm sure they're both overblown to some degree, there are kernels of truth there. So, but certainly interesting that one, that you could put a game together like this with a bunch of rich people and figure out the ones that are rich enough and bad enough at poker.
Yeah.
And that war are going to want to keep coming even though you keep beating them. So it's funny, before the show we were talking about, I'm on this James Bond thing now where I'm watching all the James Bond movies in order because I had never seen one until 3 days ago. Now I'm three movies in, right?
Yeah.
And so I watched Goldfinger yesterday where, you know, he's cheating the guy at Gin Rummy. It was just hilarious because, I mean, even I've never seen the movie. I didn't know this was a scene. But as soon as he sat down, I told the guy, no, hey, I want to sit here so I could see that pool or whatever. I'm like, I knew exactly what was going on, right? And it is so funny that the guy, of course, that was a completely fictional movie, but that guy couldn't pick up on it. It took James Bond to, you know, trick the maid into letting him into somebody's hotel room. And
I love how McGuire insists on everyone paying his ex-wife because she was dealing, giving her tips.
Yeah.
But then he doesn't want to tip Bloom, so much so that he tells her to bark like a seal to earn her $1,000 chip. You know? Scumbag.
The other one, another interesting point, when the Leonardo DiCaprio was invited because they thought he would be chum in the water for other folks to come, which I'm sure he was. Hey, I mean, I'd go play with Leo.
Yeah.
DiCaprio anytime I could. That would be awesome. But he was scared about it. He brought like, what, 5,000 or
he
something?
He didn't even put that up. He wouldn't put up the five
so
grand.
He had stake him according to stake. This account.
They said he was tighter than a gnat's ass.
Which, you know, we talk about this all the time, but, you know, people like Bill Gates, when they play, they don't play for big money either. And so to that point, to extrapolate it into a better conversation, once more, it proves that it doesn't matter how much money you have, it's how much gamble you have in you, right?
So you
could be super rich and super tight, or super poor and super risky.
Yep.
And there's plenty of people in the world on both sides of that.
Right? You know what I thought was interesting? I mean, I'm not saying that I could beat him or couldn't beat him, but when we used to watch the high stakes on TV, Guy La Liberté, the guy who owns Cirque du Soleil,
yeah.
You know, he's got all this money and everything. And, you know, he does the one drop. And, you know, when he was on there, yeah, they wanted him in the game because it wasn't as good as they were. But I thought he was decent at the game. I thought he made decent moves on TV. I thought he came away a winner a few times and against the best in the world. But they wanted him in this game because they thought he was that good. And they said they ended up beating him out of $2 million one time when they were playing with him in Hawaii. I'm like, wow, I thought he was better than that. But maybe these guys are better at poker than I think, too. Maybe Tony's
really
that good.
I think it's interesting you brought that up because I thought about the same thing. I probably watched Guy play a couple times, but probably not enough to make a good composite of how good he is, right?
Yeah.
But I think what in our minds, you know, we think about the celebrities that we know play poker, so we assume they are better than the celebrities that don't play poker, right?
Yeah.
Which in some ways is logical, in other ways completely illogical, right? So I was thinking the same thing, and then I had to take a step back and go, you know, maybe I just gave him credit for being a good player because he was playing.
Yeah, they edited that way for TV.
You
see the only hands where he played decently, but over the 8 hours of the actual session, He was horrible, you know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Or it could be this Curtis guy just making this up. So all kinds
That's true, too. All kinds of factors here.
Where it is. But yeah, no, I thought the same thing. But I really love that Leonardo, that story, because I could see some rich people. I mean, again, you go back to, like, I think Warren Buffett's one of the most fascinating people in the world. And if there's a fantastic, I think it's a documentary on HBO about him. I think it's HBO, but anyhow, it's super fascinating. We talked about how he wasn't. It's not that he's not generous. His wife kept asking him to give money away, right? And he's like, I can't. And the reason he couldn't, because he was like keeping score, because, you know, he kept compounding his the money he made and to make more, and so he didn't care about the money. He drives a pickup truck and goes to McDonald's for breakfast every day, right?
Yeah.
But it was about the score, right? And then I could list 100 names of people I've met in our lives through Annie Up who have not a dime to their name, and there's a 20-40 game going on somewhere. They're in it. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a fascinating psychological thing, I think, to look at the, you know, if you have a lot of money, but you still, that doesn't mean you're a spendthrift. And if you have no money, it doesn't mean that you don't care at all whether you can pay the rent tomorrow. Get in the game, you're going to get in the game, right? So, but yeah, this guy definitely seems, I'll give him a credit. Howard Curtis definitely seems like a character. I'm not sure he's a guy I want to hang out with, but he's definitely a character. So when they make his version of this movie, I think it's going to be a fun watch, whether it's based in, how much of it is based in truth or not, right?
Yeah. I can't believe he lived. He had a really bad problem with his heart, and it was like 25%. And then they gave him like 4 or 5 years to live, whatever it was. And then he lost a bunch of weight, and now he's back to normal, but broke, you know. Just crazy.
Well, I think that's the other lesson. Some of these folks, I mean, again, he's one of these guys that I think is more likely to be the broke guy playing the 20-40 game, right?
Yeah.
That he lives high and fast. And goes from one scam to the next, and so the scam collapses, and then he ends up broke. So we see people like that all the time. I don't know, you probably didn't get sucked into Tiger King on Netflix.
Not yet, it's coming.
But I think it's the same thing for some of those characters, that they, you know, you see them at their highest highs, but that's just because they just keep reinventing themselves, and then eventually the house of cards collapses, and then you have to build yourself back up. So.
Right, right.
It's a tough life for people that are a little bit more conservative to imagine, but that's just how those folks live. So I think Howard Curtis and Joe Exotic would be good friends.
You might get pardoned too, but we'll see.
All right, Mike Postel's legal woes are growing as one of the players who claims he cheated on a Stones Gambling Hall live stream has sued him as well. Marley Cordero alleges many of the same things in a main suit against Postel, but specifies a specific hand in which she believes Postel cheated.
So I had the chance to read this entire article as well.
What are you doing in your life?
I know, holy cow. All right, so whatever, she has a specific reason for it. I read it. She said that he actually came into the booth during an Omaha session and he knew facts about the session that no one could have known without knowing ahead of time. So she's got her reasons, whatever that is. But the thing I found interesting was she's suing him for the amount that he won in the live stream, like overall this period that they're questioning. Yeah. And I thought, are you going to give that money to all the people who lost it? Why do you deserve all that money? Are you just trying to get all the money back and then you're going to promise to equally distribute it back to the people who were cheated? Or I don't get the amount. Why is she suing for the amount that he won? She's not entitled to that amount. They would never honor that.
Well, you never know. I mean, I was watching the OJ Made in America again this week because, you know, nothing else to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the judge sentencing him to 33 years for walking to a hotel room with a gun, right?
So
anything could happen, right? But I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I watch a lot of Law and Order, so
I used to.
I think this is kind of what you normally do. You always ask for way more than you deserve, and then hope that by asking for so much, then you settle somewhere in the middle, right? So that's probably what's going on there. I guess what I find interesting is, this seems to be a kind of like the missing link in the initial lawsuit is the specific stuff. Now, I said she specifies one specific hand. That's really what it seemed like, one hand where she flopped a straight in Omaha and he folded on the turn when she claims he shouldn't have. But again, that hand, at least the way it was described in the couple stories that I read, again, you know, unless you're really into poker, you're not going to be able to explain that to a jury, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think. And it also, in my opinion, doesn't really prove that it was cheating. I mean, because some people make bad moves all the time. Now, again, I'm not defending Bostil here. I get in trouble for that all the time. But what I'm saying, though, is when you're saying, hey, here's 100% proof, it would be nice if it was 100% proof.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not like 75, and then you have to guess the other 25 or something like that. So I don't know what this really advances. I think it might be more powerful if it was part of the main suit, and that they had other folks in the game that rather than the specific lawsuit. But I don't know. Maybe it's a strategy just to wear them down with multiple lawsuits.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not a lawyer, so.
The other thing too is okay. So even if she proved somehow. You know, it was this one hand that she can prove he won. There's no jury or judge that's going to be like, okay, that was worth $250,000. You got to prove all the hands that he cheated on just because he had an option to cheat. If he could cheat, if he was cheating, you don't know how many times he was cheating when he wasn't. If you can't prove it every single time, those other ones have benefit of doubt. If this one doesn't, you can't say, okay, he showed this way of cheating once, so we're going to say, wherever we say he cheated, you have to agree with us. That's not going to work, you know?
Well, I think that's a really good point you bring up, that that's what's been missing. And again, it's not a defense of Apostle, but that's what's been missing throughout this, through all the videos and all the other stuff that we've seen, is the actual mechanism as to which how he cheated and who helped him. Because if it's just like one hand here or there, then it's really hard, I think, to prove that it was an ongoing thing and worthy of these big settlements. So that's what really needs to come out, is here's the proof of how he did it. Not just he's looking at his crotch during the game, or right, he seems to have something beeping in his hat or whatever like that. Show me how this all happened. And I know that's harder to do than it's easier to say than and harder to do. But that's what's really going to win this case, I think, for a jury and for the remaining people of public opinion that haven't made a decision on this yet. So, again, keep going back to, hey, here's a hand that no poker player in the world would play it this way. Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure I could find a poker player that's going to play every hand in any crazy way out right there. It just happens. So. I like to think that the strategy here is something a couple levels ahead of where we're thinking. Otherwise, it doesn't make much sense. And certainly, this is a very successful pro. This is funny. I no offense to her, but I hadn't heard of her until yesterday when I was putting the show together. Right,
right, right.
And again, because I don't pay attention to pros, so I don't know the names very well anymore. But she popped up in two stories yesterday. This one. And then there was a story, I think it was a Las Vegas newspaper, talking about how online poker is surging now. Unfortunately, they didn't have any stats in it. It was just all anecdotes, so that's why I didn't put it on the show notes today. But she was quoted. She was one of the players quoted in there that she's enjoying playing online, and it's a good way of continuing the game when you can't play live. And she's a strong advocate of the World Series this year being all online. So there she is, newsmaker, two stories.
Wow, remarkable.
So obviously she seems like a very competent player, very smart person. So there must be something more here than. Because just to file a lawsuit is, it's not fun.
It's just the number that got me. You know, that's how much he's accused of winning, and that's how much she wants. And it's like, is she going to give it back? That's the thing. Is that why she's doing that? She wants that amount so she can. But even so, her lawyer would get 40% of it, so she wouldn't get that anyway. It's like, you know, why not sue for whatever amount 40% minus would give her 250? And you know, so it's just weird, that number. That number was weird. You know, yeah. If she could prove that she lost two sessions to him and she bought him for 500 in both sessions, and if she doubles that because she could have won all those pots against him instead of losing them, which she may or may not have won or lost, that's the amount you're suing for. But she's suing for everything this guy's won according to them, according to when they think he cheated. And, is she going to keep it? I mean, if she won, if he could pay her, which I don't think he could, but it's an interesting number.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. There's no collection going to be happening here.
Right, right.
He doesn't have like a Heisman Trophy that they can come and take an auction off. But, at least I don't think he does, but maybe. That's the last thing. We don't have much to talk about, so might as well drown it out a little bit more. But that's the other interesting thing about this. I'm like, generally, again, from the extensive legal knowledge that I've gleaned from TVs and movies, you sue the people with the money, right? You don't sue the people that don't have the money.
Yeah.
So if you could find a way to trace it back to someone that has the money, that's who you sue, so you actually get something back out of it, right? So that's why I thought Stone's Gambling Hall here is the key there, because, again, and they're not a big, huge gaming conglomeration, but I got to assume they have more assets than Mike Postel does. So it's interesting that she chose just to sue him and not Stone's Gambling Hall.
Right.
Whether she thought they were at fault or not, it just seems that that's where you go. So the fact that she's suing somebody who probably has no money now, it makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
To what the end goal is, and more support of the thought that I have that this is part of something bigger going on that we can never see. All right, let's turn to happier things. Poker Pro Dan Smith's charitable effort, Double Up Drive, has started to fund help families affected by the coronavirus. He and other donors have pledged $250,000 total in matching funds to additional donations, which will be administered through GiveDirectly, which is an organization that gives cash donations to families in need.
You gotta love that, the good side of poker again. Gully's coming through, charitable stuff, and I love that he's doing it. That's great.
Yeah, it's nice to see folks doing it. There's another effort out there that I've read a couple articles about, but quite honestly, I don't really understand it. I think it's more of a support group rather than some kind of charitable fun thing going on. But part of me is actually a little surprised there's not more of this going on right now in the poker world. But maybe there is. Maybe people are, we're only a couple weeks into this, so it sometimes takes time for people to either come up with ideas or develop those ideas enough to make them public. So, I would think there would have been a little bit more of this going on right now. But very happy for what is happening. And if they get enough donations here, that's $500,000. So
yeah.
It's nothing to sneeze at, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not sneezing at anything now. So. sucking that in. Like, looking around before I get any kind of sneeze coming on. All right, the federal government is rolling out economic programs to help small businesses, and according to an article on Poker News by Condler and Associates CPA, professional gamblers may qualify for forgivable loans through the Payroll Protection Program, which provides money to assist with payroll, rent, mortgages, etc.
I agree with this, right? This is something that no difference. You're self-employed. There's no difference between that and any other self-employment. As soon as the IRS said, "Yeah, you can be a professional gambler," thanks to what's his name back in the was a Billy Baxter or whatever, right? So the fact that you can do it, you're a small business all by yourself, and you should be able to, cash in on that too.
Right, and your means of business have evaporated in one of the states where you can play online poker. So. There is that. I think outside of our bubble, let's not make we shouldn't want this to be well publicized, right? Because I think a lot of folks are not going to agree with us in the terms of those folks needing help right now. What was interesting is the article did mention that they didn't qualify for the economic disaster loan. As someone who just applied for both of these for us,
right.
It's interesting because the economic disaster loan, which is very similar, the reason that you wouldn't qualify for that is you have to make less than, I think, 20 or 30% of your income from gambling. So obviously these folks, unless they have other jobs and other things that they do as part of their, their company as it is, they wouldn't qualify for that. So in fact, I even know if we qualify. I mean, I think I could justify that our money comes from advertising.
Yeah. We don't gamble at all.
Gambling.
We're not gambling,
but that's interesting that was part of it. The economic disaster loan also was, it was very, very clear on things that sins, as I would imagine.
Nice.
You're involved in prurient interests, so I'm assuming strip clubs or something like that. We're not going to get any money from that as well, too. Whereas the payroll protection program didn't have any of those disqualifications in it. Also, extremely much harder to apply for, by the way.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so it'd be interesting to see how this comes out. But I bring it on the show. I mean, not that I don't think that we have too many, if any, professional gamblers listening to us. But yeah, if you're any kind of even a self-employed, the payroll protection program is definitely something you should be looking into. Or an independent contractor, all those folks qualify.
That was first come, first serve, too, wasn't it?
It depends on that one. I think that one has a little bit more money available, and that stuff changes every day. So, I mean, you're limited on what you can request, and then obviously you have to use it for certain things if you want it to be forgiven. But, you know, as I told you, we're going to apply for everything we have.
Yeah.
See which starts sticking the board and which ones fall out. Hope it's enough to get through. So. Definitely interesting times right now. So,
all right, it's up to Will. Let me ask you a question. Should we explain what PAPES is? Because we always say to read. People may not know what that is. That's a good little story. If you're jonesing for a poker game during the coronavirus, you can play in our PAPES series. Now, PAPES came about because originally it was called APES, which was the Anti-Up Intercontinental Poker Series, which was a joke because back in the day, CBS had this Intercontinental Poker show that we kind of made fun of because we said, why is it intercontinental? And we started going back and forth about joking about it, so we called our series that, and then that's how we got APE, so we said people would win bananas. Remember back in the day, you won a banana?
Yeah.
But when
somewhere.
Black Friday came and shut down basically everything we loved about online, our good friend John Somsky got together with a bunch of our regulars and said, well, let's play with play money, and we'll go on, I guess it was PokerStars, and we said, we'll do play money apes, so it became PAPES. So if you're looking to play right now with play money, we have a group that gets together every single month. The Ante Up Fans Online Play Money Tournament Series on PokerStars, it's available everywhere, so you can play no matter where you are. Details on how to join can be found at bit.ly/PAPES, PAIPS. Games are on the 6th, 16th, and 26th of every month, and it rotates disciplines with the main tournament followed by a second chance event. Buy-in for each tournament is 20,000 chips, and PokerStars gives you 15,000 in play chips every 4 hours. So you need to play a little on your own each week in order to be able to play to buy into both tournaments. But once you discover this and you like playing for play money, you can win millions pretty quickly, pretty easily on there. I've done it. So it's a good time. I've played in a few. I've won one, so I felt good about it. Join the Ante Up Fans group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands, ask call the floor questions, or just discuss anything poker-related. Check out our 11 vintage Ante Up logo designs on merchandise at anteupmagazine.com/shop. To check out t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, phone and laptop cases, coffee and drink mugs, and more with your choice of Ante Up Magazine, Ante Up PokerCast, or Ante Up Poker Tour logos. And keep them coming because we love hearing from you. We want more Hands of the Week, listener spotlights, and call to floor submissions. Just email us at podcast@anteupmagazine.com, or you can post in the aforementioned Ante Up Fans group on Facebook. We have to complete O'Malley's move today, which is always good. More content. Got to love that. So here comes part one. We'll see you on the other side, and then we'll finish it up.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $2, $5 No Limit Hold'em online home game, thanks to the quarantine we're all currently under. The game is eight-handed. This is our regular home game, so we know these players well, but we're really not sure how this will translate to online play. We're up 250 as we sit with 750. The blinds post, we get one caller, an MP. The button calls, and we're in the small blind with the ace of clubs, tray of clubs. This is a decent hand. There's already $15 in the pot, but do we raise here or just call? I've thought about this one for quite a while and ultimately decided to raise. I'd like to get heads up here and see if I can represent a stronger hand than I actually have if the flop misses me completely. We make it $30 to go. The big blind folds, the MP calls, and the button folds. The MP is a decently solid player. He doesn't step out of line all that often, and he can be tricky. His range could be pretty wide here, but it won't be completely insane. He's also up tonight. He sits with 700 up 200. There's $70 in the pot, and the flop is the 8 of spades, tray of spades, tray of hearts. Bingo, bango, bongo. We like this flop, but I'd also like to make our opponent think we're weak here. Maybe ace-queen, ace-jack, possibly even something like 7s through 4s, we check. Our opponent quickly checks behind. There's still $70 in the pot, and the turn is the 6 of hearts. I think this is where we come alive, as there are now 2 flush draws on board. We make it $40 to go, a value bet. Our opponent thinks briefly before making the call. There's 150 in the pot, and the river is the jack of clubs. I think we need to bet this one for value. We make it $75 to go. Our opponent thinks briefly before raising us to 225. So, we've invested 145 of our stack on this one. We need to put in another 150 to win 450. If we call and lose, we're down for the night. If we call and win, we're sitting pretty. Is there a case for a fold here? A raise? What's the move?
All right, obviously, sets are always in the back of our mind, but I actually think how passively we play this hand, which I wouldn't have done, has probably induced our opponent into thinking he can buy this hand from us. I'm calling, though I think a case can be made for raising.
While I love that we have the tray with the best kicker, I'm really weary of eights full here. If I play the hand back with the middle position having 8-8, it makes total sense for me. Limps, hoping to set mine, sees our raise, calls at implied odds, flops the world, and checks behind. We don't know Mal bets. We don't know. What did I write here? We don't know. We don't know.
So you fix my stuff.
It's autocorrect sometimes. I don't know what I'm saying. But he knows that Mal bets, and we just call because we still have the world. The river Mal bets, and middle position now finally raises. It's clear we're beat. So I'm going to fold grudgingly. But I just can't get that hand out of my head. So I don't know what I wrote there. We don't.
No, I think it should be.
Oh, is it no? We don't know Mal bets, so we just call because we still have the world. Or I don't know what I wrote there. But we're in position, right?
Oof, maybe check the expiration date on that milk there, buddy.
I can't remember where we are. Good, we're in a small blind, so
small
Mal
blind.
Bets.
That's what I was talking
yeah,
about,
Mal
right?
bets first. We can now let Mal bet because we're not going to check and then lose him. Mal keeps firing into us, and we have flopped the world, so we call. That's what it was. Okay, so then Mal bets again on the river, and then we raise as the other guy raises. So I'm going to fold. So here comes part two.
Hello again. So what did you decide? Are we leaving value if we just call? Is it too tight to fold? Is it too reckless to raise? I think we have to analyze our opponent before we can make an educated decision. He's fairly solid, so I think Jax would have raised preflop. Is it possible he has eights or sixes? I guess that's possible. Could he have something like nines, sevens, fives, or fours? That's also possible. It's less likely, but still possible for him to have something like ace-x of spades. Ultimately, there were just too many ways I could lose here in order for me to make a raise, but I can't justify folding. We make the call. Our opponent tables his eights, and we lose the hand. I knew online was rigged. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying sometimes coolers happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, well, it definitely makes sense, but so did other hands we had beat. I still like the call, and I go back, though, how I didn't mention this in my notes here, but I didn't like how we played this on the flop. I think when you flop a hand like that, it'd be nice to bet rather than check around and do some betting. And if that would have happened, we probably would have got our answer a little bit earlier. But yeah. Don't know if it would have saved us any money. But.
I love that. My Tobey Maguire spidey senses worked on this hand. That made me feel pretty good. It just felt like 8-8. It really did. And they said he was solid and tricky. So the fact that he was solid and tricky, I thought it could be this hand, and that's why he's just letting us walk the dog, you know. But
dog, yep.
Yeah. Sucks when Mal loses. I like when he wins.
Well, your spidey senses always work best when you don't allow people to order pizza or spit tobacco in your house. So
take off your shoes before you enter my home.
All right, it's time for the AdvancedPokerTrading.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@AntieUpMagazine.com. If you have won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership. Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. And we'll continue our Vic G parade as long as it lasts here. So, all right, I'm playing in a, he says, I'm playing a 1-3 no limit hold'em game in Biloxi. Lots of players in town for cash games. I've been at this table for a while, but new players are filling seats as players bust. I've been the most active and most aggressive, and I get the sense a few players have had enough of it. We never will have enough of you, Vic.
Yeah.
We start the hand having the table covered with our stack of 750, opening raises of $15 to $23 in this 1-3 end cap game or non-uncommon, nor is a Mississippi straddle from any position on the table. In this hand, a middle position player puts out the $6 Mississippi straddle and will act last. We have one caller before the action reaches us in the cutoff with the ace of diamonds, tray of diamonds. Well, sounds just like O'Malley.
Yeah, holy cow. Well, I'm thinking that normally I just play these hands for pretty passively. I don't want to get into some sort of raise, find out somebody behind me's got a bigger ace. Ace comes and I'm losing money because they're, you know, they have position on me or whatever. I don't know. I mean, it depends. If the straddler is going to go crazy, I may just let it go. If the straddler is just normal, hey, I just want to get more money in the pot, that's why I'm making it six, and he's not too aggressive, then I may just limp along for six and see if I flop the world. I don't mind playing suited aces, but I don't like playing them when they're wheel aces that are, you know, early in the hand. So for a raise, I mean. So if I'm going to play it, it seems like, you know, hey, you've been real aggressive, and they don't like that. So if you limp, maybe you'll get to see, not limp, but, you know, call this straddle. Maybe you'll get to see the hand. Whereas if you raise, they might say, I've had enough of this. And then they come over the top for like 50 more, and then you're stuck with your $18, $20 raise that you have to fold or whatever. So I don't know. I feel like now is a good time to just limp.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say how much I hate the Mississippi straddle. I think it's just a ridiculous notion.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But what's interesting about it in this case is when you can do it from any position on the table, it's forced us out of position pre-flop, but we still have a position after the flop because the straddle doesn't matter at that point, right? So, well, sort of position with the cutoff, not the button. But so with that in mind, generally I'm going to limp along here because I do have a hand that can flop big in position, not only just the diamonds, but also the wheel possibilities. So that's probably why I'm just going to limp along here. I haven't played the Mississippi straddle enough to really figure out the strategy on how to fight back at it. But in the absence of that knowledge, I'm going to play my position here and limp and hope to see a good flop and flop big.
I agree.
All right, our hero says, this is a nice hand to see a flop within position, and we make the call. The button folds, the small blind calls, but the big blind raises to $26. Under the gun plus one player calls, as does the straddler, and it's $20 to us, with only the small blind behind us to close out the action.
So we have one caller on top of the raise. Is that what you said?
Two callers.
Two callers.
Yeah. Under gun plus one player and the straddler called the big blind.
Yeah, if I'm feeling good and I'm dominating this table, I'm calling.
Yeah, definitely. I would think that's the case. I mean, we've stockpiled bullets here, and this is when you use them. You got a lot of players in this hand. We got a hand that could flop big and pay out. And it's a standard raise in this game, so it's not like somebody's getting out of line. And we definitely will have position now, so that's also something else that's really helpful. And it's unlikely the small blind is going to reopen the action. I don't think so.
Yeah.
All those together, I'm going to make the call.
All right, I agree.
All right, Vic says that the big blind was a player looking to simply take down the limpers. We might consider a re-raise, but he's pretty solid and has picked up two callers, so we forget about re-raising even though we're in position. Our table image might work against us and get all three players to call, or worse yet, encourage one of them to four bet. Normally I would fold here, but we're likely to close up the betting and want to see a flop with his hand. So we call the extra $20 and the small blind folds. All right. Kind of worked out so far. Let's see what the flop does.
What's the pot now? So we got four. It's 80, and then so it's like $100. $104 after the rake is probably $100.
$100 in the pot after the rake, he says. Yep.
Okay.
And we see a flop of five of diamonds, seven of diamonds, four of diamonds. Bingo, bango, bongo, he says. We flop the nut flush in position.
Jeez.
Not really the nut flush, but right?
Yeah, it is.
6-8 of diamonds would be the
nut flush. Oh, okay. I'm thinking of this. Yeah.
But close enough.
Close, though.
In position, a four-way pot. And he says, to our dismay, all three players check to us. What's the move?
I think I bet. I mean, there's enough out there that I think someone's going to want to fight for it. And it's a little sneaky that the initial raiser didn't do anything. I mean, what's he raising with? If it was any kind of pair, it's in there as a set or over it, probably. So, and if it's over cards, he should have continued to bet. If it's an over pair, I mean, I just don't understand what. Maybe he flopped a set and he doesn't want to scare anybody, but he's got to protect his hand, so it's real sneaky. But I feel like I'm going to bet. I don't know if I check behind and then... And then a turn pairs the board, and then you're kind of like, do I have this guy have the boat, or what? So I think I'll bet. I think I'll bet, half the pot or so, like $50, $35, $50, something like that.
Yeah, I definitely think this is something where with Vic's, I'm drawing a blank on the word I'm looking for, image.
Vic's image.
Table makes it more likely to bet here than if it was me in my image at a table, right? I would think the way I play, if I would come out betting here, people would fold, would fight over folding as quickly as they possibly could, knowing that I probably have the flush. And the fact that we have the ace in our hand, it'd be different if we had the queen high flush and we're hoping to at least get the ace of diamonds is still out there and bring them along. Vic mentioned that again, he's been aggressive and he says, I sense a few players have had enough of it. So, at that point, there's less danger for him betting this flop than me, right? At that case, you might as well bet, play to your image, hope that at least the big blind, who was initial raiser, might want to play back at us and not believe us and think we're trying to steal this pot. That's exactly what you want to happen. So, Vic has worked really well at cultivating this aggressive, active image, and this is a perfect spot to benefit from it. So, yeah, I'm going to bet probably half the pot, $50.
Okay.
All right. Vic says, with such a strong hand, we opt to take one off and check it back. Yeah, it's a $100 pot, and a nice bet would let us pick it up, but we're hoping for more, especially with the nuts in position. Now we're hoping for an overcard to the turn to ignite some interest. Well, we'll see what happens, but again, I stand by my opinion that...
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he's aggressive means it looks like he's trying to steal it, and it's why he only played the hand for position,
If we don't get somebody to raise us there, I do think we get at least a caller or two that just doesn't believe us.
Yeah, somebody with a king of diamonds in their hands, too, maybe.
Well, that's true, too. Yep. $100 still in the pot. The turn is the 10 of hearts, so our board now is 5 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds, 4 of diamonds, 10 of hearts. Big blind checks, under the gun player, under the gun plus one player, bets 15, and the original straddler raises to 40. Action is on us now.
Cool. So first, the first guy bet saying, I'm going to try to steal a $100 pot for 10%,
yep,
or 15%, and so that didn't work, and the other guy's like, yeah, you know what, I don't believe you, I got a piece of this now, I don't think anybody had it, and I got a diamond in my hand, maybe I had a 10 of diamonds in my hand, so I'm going to raise you. I think... This is where we raise again, because if we just call, we might get another guy who's just calling, who's got a two pair or a boat, I mean a set, and we're giving him a price to hit the boat. Whereas if I raise now, it still looks like I'm just being aggressive Vic, and somebody with a king of diamonds might be like, they might have king 10 for all we know, and the king 10 of diamonds, they might already have it, so... Who knows? I think somebody already has the flush. We might get a lot of money out of them. So let's raise.
This is an interesting point in the hand here. So no one showed any interest in the flop, including us, who had the second nuts. And that doesn't mean anybody didn't like that flop. They just wanted to see how much everybody else did, right? Now we have two people coming alive and not the person that were initially raised in the pot.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think the younger gun player is just throwing out a – it's odd that he put 15, though. That's not a bet that's going to steal a pot at all, I don't think. But it does seem like he was fishing there. The straddler raising, I think, has something. It's a matter of what it is. I hope it's a smaller flush than us. That'd be fantastic. But the big blind's checked both times after raising, so I think he's done. So now the question is, it sounds like the under gun player we both think had nothing, right? So so really in my mind, this is a heads-up pot now. So I'm not really worried about losing those other two players in between because I don't think they're going to call even the 40, let alone if we raise. So, yeah, I think we probably do need a raise here and see how strong the straddler is. It does kind of tip our hand a little bit, so I guess the contrarian view is to call the 40 and maybe hope one of these two players in between decides that 40 is worth taking the shot and then seeing what kind of carnage happens on the river. I don't know. It seems like the safer move is to raise, get heads up with this guy that we probably has a hand that we already have beat, and then we don't have to worry about being drawn out.
I don't mind. I like a raise to like something like 80 because that'll get the $15 guy to be like, all right, I'm not playing, or I've got a massive hand I'm shoving, and he was just like trying to get something out of somebody by betting 15. But if he's just stealing, he's going to go away anyway. But if you make it like 80, the 40 guy might come along because he might have the king of diamonds in his hand. That way it's hey, I'm trying to get the $15 guy out, and I'm trying to get more money out of this. And somebody could just have 6-8 straight, too. They don't, you know what I mean? They don't, and they're not worried about the flush, but it seems weird that they wouldn't have bet the flop because they didn't protect. But
it's a tough sell for me when somebody was 6-8 and raised to 26 pre-flop. So that's a really loose call at that point, but it'd be nice if that's out there.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. But
I mean, if you go through the two pair hands, it's tough to imagine anyone playing 5-7, 7-4, or 4-5 for a raise like that.
Well, I think that's what I'm wondering. This is not a flop that hits anybody really.
Unless it's, pocket pair is set mining.
Yeah, set mine. That's it. So now, I mean, any kind of 10 that's stuck around now feels like their hand is better than it really is here, right? So it's possible. I got to think players are going to be wondering if there is a flush out there paying out a playing. But that's really, I think, anybody's really worried about. So I do think that if you have a 10 here, you are a little overconfident.
Yeah.
All right. Iris says we still hold the nuts. Well, sort of. And the 3-bet would either run off everyone or work to only keep in those players with big draws or 2-pair-plus hands. Here's where I make a mistake and decide to just call the $40. The big blind and original better fold, and we're heads up. The villain has about 350 behind and is one of those players that I mentioned at the start of his hand who have had enough of me. Yeah, 3-bet of around 165 would have been a better alternative on the turn. Go ahead and chastise me, Chris. I deserve it.
Got a raise there.
With 195 in the pot, the river is the 6 of diamonds. So our final board is 5 of diamonds, 7 diamonds, 4 diamonds, 10 of hearts, 6 of diamonds, and the villain insta shoves.
Ugh. Brutal. That's brutal. So what hand has the 8 of diamonds in it? Or what hand has the 3 of diamonds in it? Well, we have the 3 of diamonds.
3 of diamonds, yeah.
So we have the straight flush, but we don't have the 8 of diamonds. What hand has 8 of diamonds in it? Would it be 8-8? It's the only hand.
Really possible.
Right, because someone's not playing ace-8 off here, I don't think. They might be playing 8-9 of diamonds. They might play that, because those are favorite hands for people. They love to play those suited connectors that are, disguised well, because they're middling.
Those are probably the only two, though.
Yeah, those two hands, 8-8 and 8-9, are the only hands that make... But there's two hands that make sense, that you play this hand that way. That's probably what you do. I would probably play 8-8 for a raise to 26 if I was the straddler and had 8-8, although would I have raised preflop with 8-8? Probably not. So if I had 8-9...
Not when somebody else raises for you. I mean, there was a lot of money preflop, and you didn't have to build a pot at that point. I mean, your straddle turned into a set mine there if you had 8-8 there. So
yeah,
that makes sense. And then you've got the overpair. flush. I might have actually bet that flop, though.
With the eight of diamonds in your hand.
With the eight of diamonds.
Or 8-9.
Because I had some backup insurance, but I probably had the best hand at that point. And I would want to put some pressure on some other players with a single diamond. So
it's a tough call to make, I tell you. It's a tough call. You have a straight flush, but it's the bottom line.
Certainly 8 diamonds or 9 of diamonds would have bet that flush, because you don't want somebody with a single diamond catching up to you. So I don't know. I mean, those are very real hands, but I think both those hands would have bet the flop. So, and, you know, we're sitting on the third nuts now, so.
Yeah.
I can't fold this, not for 350, I don't think.
Wow.
Vic might be a better player than, well, Vic.
Wow, wow.
He might be a better player in this particular hand.
I think I can fold this. I don't know. Wow. That's a lot of money on a flip here. You know, because really it's two hands that you can only
put them on. We're down to one card. One card beats us here. That's what's so difficult. Now, obviously, if one card makes sense, then it doesn't matter that it's one card. And there are reasons to believe that one card makes sense here. But
if you had the straight flush, would you shove? I mean, you'd want to get value for this hand, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, he could think that, you know, we were sitting on a flush and not wanting to raise to keep us in. And now that we got the straight flush, that'll be an easy call. Yeah, but you are taking a little bit of chance. Now you're having to assume that we do have.
That's where the call was bad. Because we had. Right? The call's the bad thing.
Assume that we have a flush now.
That's why his call was bad. Because if he calls, that looks like he's trying to hit the fourth diamond with his ace, and now the guy's got a straight flush, and he knows that you've hit your flush that you were calling for on the turn rather than already having it. And so now that's why the guy can justify shoving, because he thinks you're going to call with your ace of diamonds or your three of diamonds. And so
he has to be sure we have that. That's what's weird about this. He has to be sure we have this, because there's no way we're calling this off without a diamond in our hand.
Right, but that's why he thinks you called. Because he thinks you have the diamond. That's why you call the turn bet. And that's why he thinks who calls there who's not drawing? You know?
Well, again, this is one of my weaknesses. I probably tend to hedge my bets a little more than I should at the table. So if I was him, I would hedge on whether I was right on that decision or not and bet something that maybe can get some money out of. But then again, I guess now I'm thinking about it, talking out loud, that you don't make a call here unless you have a diamond anyhow. So you might as well just bet it all and hope.
Yeah.
You get that call. That's the other way of thinking about it. So, I don't know.
I think I'm going to fold.
Take time to really talk these things out rather than sit at the table, right?
Yeah, I'm going to take the opposite of you just to see one of us is right. I'm going to fold.
Okay. You're folding, I'm calling.
Yeah.
All right. Vic says, before the dealer can count out the $354 bet, I snap call and table my nut flush. Not saying that I actually had the bottom end of a straight flush. The villain tables the 9 of clubs, 8 of diamonds.
Yeah. 9-8, so he called a raise at 9-8 off, too. Yeah, he was the straddler, right?
Yeah, he was a straddler, but he still called that $20
raise. He called a $20 raise because it was a straddle and then got him in. So then he has basically only a gutter to a straight flush and a gutter to a straight, and he calls the turn bet.
2 overcards, too. I mean, not that that's exciting.
No, I know, but those aren't necessarily outs when there's 3 diamonds out. Yeah, wow. So I forget how it went now. I know there was a $15 bet and then a $40 bet. Which one did he make?
He made the 40. He raised
That's it. What's interesting. The 10 comes, and he didn't improve. And he still doesn't have a hand. And he raises to 40.
Yeah, wow, you're right.
That's shocking. Yeah, when he does that, I think
that's really interesting. Going back to our whole discussion on the flop with eights and stuff, eights wouldn't have made that raise either there, right?
Probably not.
Because now a 10's there, so now I mean the 10's got you beat. Right. So now you're and then if a diamond comes, you can't feel confident that your flush is good unless it happens to be the exact diamond that came there.
Of course, the 8-9 doesn't want to make that bet either.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So we spent a lot of time talking about those two hands being possible, and now that I look back at the action, I don't think either one of them were possible. This guy was just really loose.
Wow.
And got there.
That's brutal.
Really loose throughout the whole thing.
Brutal.
Wow. Now, again, you go back to straddlers. Straddlers generally are looser players. I mean, I don't want to pigeonhole them all into that thing, but you have to have a little gamble in you to put $6 out blind when you don't have to. Now, of course, you're acting last. So there were some strategical considerations there, but unlike the end of the gun race or straddle. But so if you got somebody with a little gamble in them, then some of those hands might be more possible. But again, it's so weird that I got blinded by that 10 on the turn and thought that either of these hands are possible. So I don't know. Vic, I feel bad that you didn't see the board the way we did there, dude, but I also don't think it's going to change your opinion. I think you still had to make that call there, and that guy's got to be telling this hand of the week.
Well, I tell you, this shows you how difficult this game really is, because we went back and rationally played this hand over and said, no one plays 8-9 off there that way.
Yep.
And so this goes back to the original Mike Postel conversation we had about no one plays it that way. Well, look at this guy. No one plays it that way. But you only shove there if you know you have the ace three of diamonds. Your opponent has ace three of diamonds, right? It's like he knew what Vic had. And then how could he bet that 40 there with nothing except gutters, right? And gutters and a baby flush if he doesn't make the straight flush.
Well, you can feel a little bit better about that shove because you really need – it doesn't have to be the ace of diamonds at that point.
Right. It could be a three. It could be the
king. Queen, jack, 10.
Exactly.
9 even. You know, any diamond that's better than ours would probably make that call, and we know we have the best diamond. So
We go through our entire home game right now, all the players in our home game, and none of them would play that 8-9 that way.
No.
None of them. None of us would raise the $15 bet to 40 unless we're playing the people we know they're going to fold. If we know the 15 guy is full of crap and the rest of us are weak and we're going to fold. So maybe he's doing that on the come, but even the 8-9 calling the $20 raise, 8-9 off, to be out of position, most of the hand, because you have people behind you who are probably going to call. To me, it's just, I don't know too many people would play the hand that way. That was pretty loose and pretty wild, and it worked out perfectly for him. That's the stuff that pisses me off when they do stuff like that and it works out.
The only thing I could defend on the $40 raise is that obviously the big blind who raised pre-flop decided he did not want any piece of this hand anymore after the flop, right?
Right.
So you know he's out. I think we all agree this under the gun player was just making a stab, right? And then so now that guy's really just taking a chance that we happen to have a hand like we did. Otherwise, we might get out. So it might be his way of stealing it with the backup of actually being able to hit one card to win it all. So not defending it, but it doesn't look as bad as it initially did. Other parts of this, how we play this hand, look way worse, I think.
I'm not used to Vic losing.
And that's a tough one. That's a tough lose, the loss there. Wow.
Must be the quarantine. It's making me feel all giddy. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.